Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Frederick Law Olmsted is the pioneering 19th century landscape architect who designed some of the country's best known and best loved urban green spaces, including Central Park in New York and Boston's Emerald Necklace. A new documentary about this singular man says that Olmsted didn't just design city parks, he was instrumental in designing America. Lawrence Haught is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and director of the new film, Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America, which is screening tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts. He joins us now. Larry, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, Designing America, it's a pretty provocative subtitle. What did you mean by that?
Olmsted was everywhere. The way a park in America looks has a lot to do with Olmsted's design sensibilities. You know, when you walk through a park and you see a water feature or a serpentine path or some woods that open up into a broad meadow and then close up again, and then you come across some kind of surprise, something you didn't expect, that's an Olmstedian design. But he didn't only design parks. He designed college campuses and suburbs and cemeteries. And in his lifetime, he worked on 3,000 projects.
Now, in hearing you describe the key features of an Olmsted design, anyone living in the greater Boston area immediately knows what you're talking about because we've been there. But did he ever articulate himself what his philosophy was for park design?
Oh, did he ever? What a lot of people don't know about Olmsted is that he was a reformer first, before he was a landscape architect. In fact, he didn't declare himself a landscape architect until he was 42 years old.
Right.
And before that, he had been a sailor and a surveyor and a writer. He was part of one of the Transcendentalists. So everything Olmsted did, he did with an eye to how he could improve American society and make it more democratic.
I feel like you can see the threads of all of this previous experience that you were talking about coming together in what becomes his, you know, his urban green space masterpieces. I mean, for example, a couple years ago, we talked to Justin Martin, who's the author of an Olmsted biography called Genius of Place, and he said that he thinks Olmsted deserves his due as a pioneering environmentalist in the United States, even before he became a park designer. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And Olmsted is credited with beginning or helping to begin the preservation movement in the United States. What Olmsted did in Niagara Falls particularly is set up the idea that the state could come in and set aside land and say that this land is sacred. Now, we don't often think of Niagara Falls as that kind of sacred place, but it was a wilderness symbol in the United States. And by the time Olmsted saw it, it had been almost completely destroyed by these factories that had ruined the view. And not only that, that you had to pay to see the falls. And Olmsted fought a 10 to 15 year battle to set aside Goat Island in the middle of Niagara Falls and call it the New York Reservation, Niagara Falls Reservation. The idea that a place could be set aside in 1885, that led to the Forever Wild Clause in the New York State Constitution, which is how parts of the Adirondack got preserved. And that, of course, eventually led to the formation of the National Park Service and then eventually in 1964, the Wilderness Act. So you can see a lot of American conservation history starts with what Olmsted did.
And also the idea you mentioned earlier about social reform and parks. I mean, he had experience, again, before he even designed his first landscape. What was it, traveling to the South on behalf of the newly born New York Times?
Yeah, the New York Times said, we need somebody to go down South, almost as a foreign correspondent, because the South was a foreign country to most Northerners. And when Olmsted was touring, he was writing about the economy of slavery. He went to the South as a kind of a reluctant abolitionist. He thought that the slaves weren't ready yet for freedom. But after a couple of years of touring the South, Olmsted started shipping howitzers and guerrilla war manuals out to the Free Kansas movement. You know, this is sort of suspect activity for him.
Okay, so let's talk about how all of this prior variety of life experience makes its way into Olmsted's obviously most profound lasting legacy, and those are all the urban green spaces. Because, Larry, you had mentioned Olmsted as a social reformer, and that's really at the heart of his landscape design. And in the course of your research, you spoke to Margaret Dyson, who's director of historic parks for the city of Boston, and she kind of gives us a glimpse into how that social reform plays into even something simple as little doorways in places like Franklin Park.
Olmsted was a genius at making spaces feel bigger than they might be, feel smaller than they might be, using sight lines to shape your experience of a space. Going through Ellicott Arch in Franklin Park, you're going through a small, contained space and opening it up into this field. The sense of being out of the city in a heartbeat is just extraordinary.
I have to tell you that when I first started this project, Margaret met me in the garden, and we hopped into a little golf cart, and we did a tour of the entire Emerald Necklace, ending up in Franklin Park. And that's where she said, you know, this is my neighborhood, this is where I grew up, and this is where my grandparents were. And they were in those triple-deckers that were full of Irish immigrants who came here and were filling the cities. And Olmsted, when he was designing these parks, he really was keeping in mind this kind of cauldron, this crucible that was happening in American cities, where we had so many people flooding in with no place to go. And he thought of the parks as an escape valve, and he thought that these people deserved to have it. But it was more than that. He felt that they would be democratized, they would understand democracy better, that they, that the contact with nature would change them. He wanted people to have the privilege that the upper crust white people had. If you're in Central Park, for example, and you're up in the ravine on the Upper East Side, it's meant to look like the Adirondacks, which was the playground of the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So this is one of the things that I love most about what you explore in the documentary about who Olmsted was, because, you know, as you're talking about, he really felt this sense of social mission in designing these urban spaces. Is this one of Olmsted's most lasting legacies in terms of people's personal experiences of the spaces he designed, that you don't really even feel like you're in a designed environment?
Yes, it is. And in fact, at the end of the film, we have somebody who talks about how, as a child, she goes to Central Park and how important it was for her. She didn't know who Olmsted was, but the idea that there was this special, magical place. That very same person also talks about how Olmsted is very much like Disney, and that some people bridle at that. You know, to combine those two names is blasphemy in some way. But Olmsted understood what people needed out of their recreation experience. They needed something to calm them, but also something to entertain them, something that had a variety, like Margaret Dyson said, you know, you have surprises, you don't know what you're going to expect. And a Disney landscape is completely engineered. The difference is, although Olmsted landscapes are completely engineered also, they take into account what the natural land looked like. Mm. And he uses the natural land to perfection.
Well, finally, I just wanted to explore with you a little bit more about really what is Frederick Law Olmsted's legacy. Because you, in the documentary, you interview the writer Adam Gopnik, and we've got a clip of that here, because he argues that Olmsted actually has a double legacy.
On the one hand, he's a super pragmatist. He's a problem solver. At the same time, he's a dreamer. What his parks are all about is finding immensely practical solutions to the problem of building a dream in the middle of a city.
Well, Larry, the problem of building a dream in the middle of a city, why is that a problem?
Well, Olmsted really wanted to flip the paradigm. People think, okay, you put a park into the city and that's the relief valve. But he really was the opposite. He wants the people to feel like the whole area is a park and the city is within it. And that really works in Boston, because when you turn your head anywhere you're walking along the riverway and you see something beautiful, Olmsted's legacy is a more than that. Because he had not only design sensibility, but he had the idea that we should maintain and preserve these places that give us this pleasure. And Olmsted also had a very practical legacy, which is he started an incubator. When he moved up to Boston, he brought in interns, mostly from Harvard, and that started the first landscape architecture school in the country, which became the Urban Planning Department. And the idea of urban planning is something that Olmsted, even though he never used that phrase, urban planning, is something he believed in, that you can't just let these cities grow without somebody paying attention to what they look like and how they operate. And that idea that everybody deserved a park, that's one of Olmsted's greatest legacies.
Here we are, though, more than a century, basically a century and a half after Olmsted makes his mark on America, as you say. Do you still think that his vision, his design, remains the gold standard for urban green spaces, or has the thinking evolved in terms of how nature and green space should work within a city?
If anything, Olmsted's designs are more popular than ever. And the impetus to design in the Olmsted model is stronger than ever. Olmsted had this idea that he would tell all the city planners that you must go outside the city limits and buy land when it's cheap and hold on to it. And then people will build houses around those parks, and that will create a reserve of tax dollars from the property values so you could pay for the parks. Unfortunately, Olmsted did not anticipate just how expensive it would be to maintain a park. And now you see park conservancies all over the United States that are public-private cooperatives, and they have to have both private money and public money because it's not enough of either to maintain a park on its own. And you see that in Boston, you see it in New York and Chicago, all over the country. So the positive thing is that we have these parks and there's more of them, and the problem is there's not enough money to maintain them.
Well, Lawrence Haught is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and director of the new documentary Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America. It airs nationwide on PBS in June, but you don't have to wait that long because there is a screening of the film tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts. There's a link to more information on that at our website, radioboston.org. Larry Haught, what a pleasure it's been to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, too. Thank you.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR Boston, NPR's news station.
Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Dina Rosendorf, Alex Kingsbury, Emmajean Weinstein, and Kathleen McNerney, with help from Jamie Bologna.
Tim Skog is our technical director.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. I'll be away for the next few days, but Meghna will be here to take good care of you, so join her again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.